Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a program brought to you every week by the Pacifica Network. Our purpose is to analyze major economic events and trends, the forces, both national and global, that shape our jobs, our incomes, taxes, debts, what we buy, how we save. In short, the economic dimension of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics at several universities all of my adult life. Currently, I'm a visiting professor of economics in the graduate program for international affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write economic columns on events in the news for truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary every day. Check them out at truthout.org. If you are interested in more elaborations in the documents that we refer to on these programs and in the general kind of analysis you hear and see in what we do, please visit the two websites we maintain for precisely that purpose. The first is rdwolf.com, and there you will find video, audio, written texts, all kinds of material about my work in economics, interviews with me on the media, and so on. The second website is democracyatwork.info. There you will see all that we have gathered to elaborate on one of our major projects, which is the development of interest in and support for enterprises that are organized in a new and different way, where workers themselves are their own boards of directors, where workers themselves take control of their jobs and their work lives. Finally, please keep sending your questions and your comments to our programs. You can do that through either of those two websites, rdwolf.com or democracyatwork.info. We use your questions and comments not only for the last segment of each show where we respond to them, but also in shaping how this program is designed week after week. Last but not least, let me also remind you that both websites have a donate button on them. It costs money to prepare all this material. It costs money to maintain those websites and so on. And so we would like to ask your help in whatever way you can, by hitting that donate button. You will see the different ways you can support us financially, and needless to say, we would be very grateful if you were willing to do that. Let me turn, as we always do then, to the shorter updates with which each program begins. The first one has to do with a peculiarity, I'm trying to be polite here, in Obamacare. That law, which is going into effect now and will in the next year or two, to provide what America calls health insurance for its people. It is a bare shadow, a poor cousin to the kinds of national health insurance that all the other industrial countries in the world provide. But it is better than what we had, with some exceptions, and I want to alert you to one of them. It turns out that under the Affordable Care Act, that's its official name, employers who have more than 50 full-time employees, and I'll have a word about that in a minute, are required to provide a family health benefit to their workers, if they're large employers. And we checked into that after we learned that the average cost to provide family health care insurance is about $11,429 a year to do that. And the law provides a penalty for companies that don't do that, who have more than 50 employees full-time, but who do not provide the care that the law requires. And what's the penalty if they don't do it? $2,000. That's right. An employer of more than 50 persons who chooses not to obey the law on providing health care for his or her employees would save almost $9,500 by paying the penalty rather than providing the insurance. Why in the world would you make a penalty so much smaller, thereby providing an incentive for employers to escape the point and purpose of the law by choosing the cheap penalty rather than the relatively more costly insurance for their employees? When I looked into it, I was told this was necessary to get the support of wavering lawmakers to pass the bill at all, to make this slap on the wrist to employers even more delicious by making it so much cheaper than providing health care. The other thing this law does is say full-time workers count to the 50 that you have to have if you're going to provide legal health insurance. Part-timers count 2-for-1. In other words, 2 part-timers are the equivalent of 1 full-timer, which means what? Which means employers are going to be given another incentive under this Obamacare to substitute part-time for full-time people, because if they had 50 full-timers and they converted them into, say, 80 part-timers or part of them, they could escape the minimum that they need to have to be required to provide health insurance. So this is a law which inadvertently, one wonders, stimulates part-time work instead of full-time. And remember, part-timers often can be given fewer benefits of all kinds than full-timers, as well as the incentive to not provide it at all because the penalty is so low. Our next short update is a kind of morality lesson. It has to do with a famous French historian named Dominique Venner, V-E-N-N-E-R. Dominique Venner was a man with a very bizarre life, but what made him famous, perhaps most famous of all, was the way he ended his life, May 21st, 2013, a few weeks ago. He walked into the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris, the greatest cathedral in all of France, an immense structure on an island in the middle of the Seine River that cuts Paris in half into 2 parts. In the cathedral, he took out a gun and killed himself. This, of course, made the news, as you can imagine. He was a famous historian. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about this man's life. And the lesson here, which I'll tell you at the beginning, is that here's a life shaped by capitalism and the way capitalism works. And yet, in this man's conscious writings and in his speeches, because he was famous, you never saw a word about the influence of capitalism on shaping all of his life, including its end. Here's how it begins. In a race with other capitalist countries, 2 centuries ago, France carves out colonies around the world, and particularly in Africa. In the north of Africa, it carves out what eventually becomes perhaps its most important colony, Algeria, a major country on the northern rim of Africa. The French take over that part of the world. They use it for the benefit of the French. They subordinate and repress the Algerians. Eventually, after World War II, the Algerian people rise up in the independence struggles that happened across so much of the colonial world, eventually fighting for their independence from France, which they eventually won. The story of Dominique Venner begins as a person caught up in that struggle who joins the secret army of France that tried to prevent independence, that tried to fight down and repress the independence struggles. That's where he enters his young life. When that struggle, which was often very violent, when that was lost, when the Algerians won their independence from France, Dominique Venner found a new struggle to engage in. the struggle against communism. There also, capitalism plays a role, doesn't it? Capitalism, from its beginning, has always provoked critics and opponents, people who didn't like this or that aspect of capitalism, people who often thought that the world could do better than capitalism. It spawned socialists, communists. It spawned thinkers like Karl Marx, leaders like Lenin, and so on. And of course it sparked people who were horrified by the critics of capitalism, who were horrified by the notion that you could go to a further, more developed stage of human life called socialism, communism, or other names, and who decided to fight against any movement beyond capitalism. Dominique Venner got caught up in that too. But he no more understood capitalism's role in creating the capitalism versus socialism struggle than he had understood the role of capitalism in bringing France to a colonial commitment and to provoking the rebellion of the colonial subjects to their subjugation. The colonials in Algeria did as the colonials in the United States had done earlier. They fought a violent revolution to break free. But the role of capitalism was never clear in Dominique Venner's life. When the Soviet Union imploded, and even earlier, Dominique Venner got to another struggle. This one also shaped by capitalism. It turned out that industrial capitalism in France, where he lived, was like industrial capitalism in most other capitalist countries. It was always looking for cheaper labor, and it found the cheaper labor in the old colonial territories. They were now independent, but their people were poor, one of the legacies of colonialism. And so those people began to come to Germany and France and Britain and the United States looking for the decent jobs that colonialism had denied them in their countries of origin. And so France became a country to which many, many Muslims, particularly from North Africa, where France had had the colonial territories we now call Tunisia and Morocco and Algeria. They came across the Mediterranean and settled in France. And Dominique Venner became agitated that what he called French culture, European identity, was being undermined and challenged by the huge wave of non-European Muslim people, particularly from North Africa. And he became a tremendous struggler against multicultural education and a multicultural society. He fought against Algerian independence. He lost. He fought against the communist menace. Mixed bag. And he fought against multiculturalism, and he lost. And in the end, he became so despondent that he walked into the Notre Dame Cathedral and killed himself without ever understanding the relationship between his stormy life and the economic system he inadvertently supported because he didn't see its connection. The third short update is something I owe to a professor at the University of Ottawa in Canada. Trained in labor economics and other issues, his name is Miles Corak, C-O-R-A-K. He has a blog in which he showed something very interesting I wanted to bring to your attention. He looked at the amount of money spent by American families on the following, their children. And in particular, on the books, computers, high-quality childcare, summer camps, private schooling, and other things that promote the capabilities of children as they grow up. And here's what he found. Back in the 1970s, families in the poorest tenth of the United States spent a total on average of $835 for those things, for their children, per child. Whereas families in the top 10% of the American distribution of income among families spent $3,536, a ratio of 4 to 1. So if you're born into one kind of family, you get four times the help in developing your skills than in the other. But then he compared that to 2009, I believe was the year, or 2008, it's not clear. Sorry, 2008. How much money was spent? In the bottom tenth, $1,315. So an increase from before. But in the top tenth, 8,872, a ratio of 7 to 1. People in the top tenth spending 7 times more for the enrichment of their children's capabilities than people at the bottom. That's why the gap between rich and poor is so important. It is a self-reinforcing, self-aggravating phenomena. It makes itself worse. If you allow inequalities of income in a society, they become worse. And one of the ways they do that is by the disproportionate help that upper-income people give to their children. We always knew that. Miles Corek, the professor at Ottawa, proves it with his statistics. Last, before we turn to our important interview for today, is a report by the Century Foundation, used to be called the 20th Century Foundation, and you can find it on the web at tcf.org, Century Foundation, did a study of community colleges. And it's important to mention that community colleges are the single most important institution to enroll, educate, and train people in higher education in the United States. They're the biggest one. And here's the report of a study of community colleges in America I think you will find interesting for what it says about what's happening in the United States. Excuse me. First, 81% of students entering community college for the first time say they eventually want to transfer and earn at least a bachelor's degree in a regular four-year college. 81% say they want to. 12% are the number that do. We've made it so difficult to get through the program that it goes from 81% who want a full education, which will benefit society the most, but only 12% get through. If ever you wanted a definition of a crisis, there it is. Second, there is a stunning lack of investment in community colleges. There are many statistics in the report. I'm going to give you one which I found so dramatic that it says more than anything else. Between 1999 and 2009, community college funding in the United States increased just $1 per student. In private research universities, per student funding jumped by $14,000 per student. $1, $14,000. What can one say? The mouth drops open with disbelief at so disproportionate a service of the students at the top at the expense of catastrophic neglect of the institution that trains most of the people in America and an even larger percentage of those from middle and lower income households. That is a failure of a public higher education system, if I ever saw one. Okay, so much for our short updates. I want to turn now to my guest today, Dr. Harriet Fraud. She is a full-time psychotherapist in New York City. She's also a hypnotherapist. She publishes widely in truthout.org that I've mentioned already today. In Tikkun and a host of other publications. Her latest work is a chapter on personal and sexual life in the forthcoming book, Imagine a Socialist America, that is due for publication in September of 2013 by HarperCollins. Welcome very much to our program. She also maintains a website at hfraud.com. That's spelled F-R-A-A-D. So welcome very much. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
I want to ask you to draw upon your practice as a psychotherapist and hypnotherapist to help us understand something that we talk about on this program often and that I'm going to summarize as follows. We have seen now an economic crisis plunging huge numbers of people, vast majorities, in many countries, North America, Japan, Western Europe, and all the rest of the world, into real suffering, deprivation, decline. We have seen the explosion of the Arab Spring, of Occupy Wall Street, of daily strikes and movements in Europe. But here in the United States, with the exception of Occupy Wall Street, we see much less in the way of a fight back by working people than we see elsewhere. And we wonder about it. And I talk about some of the historical reasons. We don't have organizations. The labor movement has been declining. We have no socialist and communist parties the way other countries have had. But I wanted today to ask you to help us understand what is going on in the intimate, the personal, the sexual, the family life of American working people, the kinds of folks that come to see you in your practice, to help us understand the obstacles to workers, particularly collectively fighting back against a deteriorating economic situation that hurts them, that threatens the future of their children, that is a serious problem, because we know that from countless investigations and polls. So let me begin with a big question. How do you see the current unemployment, loss of job benefits, loss of job security, falling income? How is it affecting the personal, intimate lives of American citizens, and particularly what you find and see in your practice?
First, I'll talk about a wider picture, and then I'll narrow down on two cases. The larger picture is that one can envision mental health and emotional well-being as a table with four legs to hold that table up. One leg is personal relationships that are close. They can be intimate partnerships with a sexual partner. They can be deep friendships. They can be compelling, honest family relationships. And those are very profound, close relationships. The next leg on our table is a slightly wider circle of connections at work, connections in the neighborhood, connects a slightly wider connectivity with individual people. A third leg is connections with people around a shared goal. It could be an active PTA that really works together. It could be a blood drive where people have one blood drive after another for their community. It could be a church group. And it could be a political group where people create a political party or a political mission that connects them, like supporting abortion and birth control rights. And they get to know each other around a shared belief system and a shared morality. And here I would think of as politics as morality in the world, morality that is acted on in the world. So we're talking, we now have three legs
of our table.
And a fourth is a general belief in a future that people can envision for themselves, for their children, for their country, a sense of hope.
And so these are the four legs that hold up
mental health,
the mental health of an individual.
Of an individual.
So that's
right.
He or she needs all of those.
They need these things to be healthy. Now,
what's happening in the United States to those legs?
Exactly. Sometimes one can wobble, the rest can hold it up. Just like if you have a table, one leg is a little bit shaky because it's not tight yet.
Right.
Okay, the table's going to stand. At this point, all four legs of the American mental health table are shaking.
Okay, let's go through.
Yeah, let's go through how they are shaking. If you want to now, if you want to go on to another thing,
no,
you can,
fine.
But I'm sort of trying to do that. In terms of intimate relationships, the large majority of relationships that terminate, you know, that have marriage involved are disrupted and destroyed.
That's our divorce rate.
50%, we have the highest divorce rate in the world. 50% of American couples, now gay couples can join that divorce, those divorce statistics, of American couples end their relationships with legal formal separation or divorce. There's another 10 or 15% minimum that divorce without bringing the legal establishment into their arrangements, without spending the money. They usually don't have assets to fight over, and they split. And then there are also couplings that never bother being married that split. So we're talking about the vast numbers of
a majority
personal
of Americans.
Family. Right. 75% of kids live at some point without their biological parents. And that's partly because 42% of them are born outside of a marriage in the first place. And people who are not married tend to split up more easily. So we're talking about the intimate level being in terrible trouble. And then one can go on to a slightly wider social circle.
The second leg.
Friends, the second leg. Americans have fewer connections of all kinds. This is the second. Now we'll talk about the third. Organizations. There are fewer Americans involved in all those organizations now and those wider groups than were in bowling leagues alone in 1970. That's Thomas Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, which is then buttressed by the other research, but that's the most thorough. A quarter of Americans have no one they can call, no intimate friend, no wider family friend or personal friend, no person in a group that they can call in the direst circumstances. It's one of the reasons that the suicide rate is going up so high, as well as the child abuse and other indicators
of
terrible, terrible trouble. And so those take care of one, two, and three. In terms of four, what has happened was, and here I would expand on what was different in America from what there was in Europe, which is American exceptionalism. As you've pointed out, from 1820 to 1970, profit and wages went up in tandem. Profits were... Then in 1970, wages leveled, profits kept soaring, and profitability, and what they call productivity, kept going. And so money was accumulated at the top and lost for the mass of Americans, who still retained the American dream that they could make life better for their children, that they could make life better for themselves, that America was the greatest, that we were the most equal of all nations where everybody had a chance. Well, in 1970, we were the most egalitarian nation in the Western industrialized world. Now we are the least in the whole Western industrialized world. But people haven't adjusted their own concept. You can make it if you really try. If you're so smart, why aren't you rich? You can get ahead. And they feel personally shamed and blamed
because
that they can't
ahead.
Make it. That they're borrowing on credit cards to try to make it and show that they're getting ahead, collapsed in debt. And that's not open to them. They tried evangelical organizations for a while, Hope in Another World. That is starting to collapse. And some of the mega churches are becoming community centers because
they can't sustain
that hope. And so that fourth leg, which is hope in the future, is also shaking. So you have, that's one of the reasons that, you know, one out of 10 children has it's between 1 and 10 and 1 out of 17. Let's take the conservative number. 1 out of 17 has a mental health crisis. It's why the United States, which has 6% of the world's population, has 66% of the drug use in terms of psych drugs. And that doesn't count people prescribing themselves alcohol or whatever else. So we're talking about a huge mental health crisis. And now we can take it down, unless I'm talking too long, then you should tell me. Let's take it down to two case histories.
Well, before we do, I want to draw a summary and take our mid-program break briefly.
Good
we'll
idea.
We'll come right back to this. Then the summary is that you're beginning to shape an answer to the question, why are Americans not fighting back in a way that would carry forward the Occupy Wall Street movement and be more like what is happening in a number of other countries, most notably recently Brazil and Turkey, with their uprisings to surprise everybody. You're answering that question for us by saying that the four supports for a healthy mental health of
and
our
for
people,
hope
and for the hope that's part
and
of
and agency, the sense I can do something, I'm important.
That the four legs holding up that sense of self, that mental health, are really compromised in the United States.
Yes.
So I'm going to want to come back after our short break and continue to explore this argument and ask you to draw on your own practice to give us illustrations. Everyone, please stay with us. We'll be right back after our typical short break at this time.
Going down a dirty inner city side of the road, I plotted. Madness passed me by, she smiled high, I nodded. Looked up as the sky began to cry, she shot it. Met a girl from Dearborn early 6 o'clock this morning, Colfax. Asked about a bag, suburbia such a drag, won't go back. Cause Papa don't allow no new ideas here. And now he sees the news, but the picture's not too clear. Mama, Papa, stop, treasure what you got, soon you may be caught without it. The curfew set for rain, will it ever all be straight? I doubt it.
Welcome back, everyone. I am interviewing Dr. Harriet Fraud, a practicing psychotherapist and hypnotherapist in New York City. We are talking on Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, and I want to get right back to the conversation by asking a follow-up question, which is, one of the most stark economic statistics of the last few years has been the growing gap between rich and poor in the United States, which, as you pointed out yourself before the break, is greater now than it was in the 1970s by a large factor, that we went from being one of the most equal of capitalist industrial countries, the most equal, to the least equal. So tell me, how do you define this growing inequality shaping people's feelings, their capacity for agency, for fighting back, their sense of self, their mental health? How is that playing out in the intimate life?
Well, I'll give two examples.
Please.
One is of a client who we'll call Carl, who came to me because he was seriously suicidal. He's in his 50s, and that's peak suicide time for American men, because that's where you start being completely unemployable, according to the New York Times. That's where you can look forward to unemployment the rest of your life, even after you lose your benefits. That's true of men and women. What happened was he lost his business because of the recession, and his wife then worked extra, and he felt utterly useless. He did more housework, but she was pissed at him, and their sex life collapsed. She didn't feel attracted to him anymore. He didn't feel like a man either, because he defined his manhood on his ability to support his family. And even though his wife worked before, she had the luxury of knowing that her work was extra and not crucial to the survival of their family. And when that was taken away from him, that sense of manhood, his sense of male sexuality collapsed. Just a little parenthetical, That's one of the reasons that pornography viewing has gone crazy. Testosterone creams are one of the best-selling pharmaceuticals and so on. And he became very depressed. He became very depressed because without a movement and without hope, he felt it was his personal shame and his personal incapacity as a man
and
to sustain a job.
And so that went even to the point of questioning the continuation of his life.
He felt that his life no longer had any purpose, that his biggest thing in his life had been his relationship with his wife and children. The wife thought a lot less of him and made it clear to the children, who did too. A big part of his manhood was his sense of sexuality, which wasn't really satisfied with the pornography he watched extensively, even though women were humiliated routinely and men were triumphant. He knew that wasn't about him. And he felt useless and unappreciated, and he also felt deeply ashamed as a man. And so that's one of the results of all of those table legs shaking, and it has a lot to do with the economy. He's a very talented man and highly skilled. But he's in his 50s, his late 50s, so.
Let me ask you a question that has fascinated me. Did he ever think or consider that what was happening to him was not about his business and his efforts and his work, but was part of a larger economic process of which he was just a consequence? Did he make his own choices and behavior the cause?
Yes.
Did he not notice that there were tens of thousands of people just like him? That it would be very peculiar if suddenly tens of thousands of people who had been quite competent and successful in their work suddenly became incompetent and failures? That this is not about these individuals suddenly going through a transformation of themselves as individuals, but was a social process? That he was a victim of? This didn't occur?
No, I mean, he came from a family in which his father took enormous pride that he made it against all odds. He felt that what had been true for 150 years, as long as you were white and male, you could get a family wage and do a decent job and get pride in it. And like many Americans, he does not read anything but the Post and the Daily News, which just talk about gossip and don't really talk about what does it mean to be unemployed. And although the figures are on the radio, he's in a big part of America, which is a depoliticized culture that doesn't see that the things going on, and he doesn't vote. He thinks, I don't want to encourage them, you know. They don't have anything to do with me anyway. On that, he is right. They have to be very well-funded and not by people like him, even though he had a solid middle-class life. And he didn't see himself as part of a social
process,
a social life, you know, a throbbing life with all of these possibilities. And he had spent so much time on building his business that his only real personal connections were familial, and he was bereft.
So when that fell apart and the family moved away from him, he had no supports left.
He had no supports left. He wasn't an activist. And even his physical body started to collapse because the body-mind is one system. He went to an endocrinologist and a urologist. His testosterone levels had plummeted because the body and the mind are so intimately connected. But taking medication for that didn't help. He has changed his mind through therapy, which is also very much informed by helping him see that he's part of a social problem and that he has a chance. But
or at least that he doesn't blame himself.
He lost hope entirely. Yeah. So he wasn't thinking of, okay, I'm going to join a really radical organization, because he didn't feel his life mattered. He didn't feel he mattered. He didn't feel the hope, I can change. He also, there was this tradition, he's from an immigrant family, that you can make it if you really try. As long as you're white, as long as you're male, you can make it if you really try. And that, therefore, if he didn't make it, it was his fault.
Now that, this process of a culture that trains you to blame yourself for these social events is one of the most important phenomena for socially aware Americans and foreigners, for that matter, too, in other countries, to understand, because it is a debilitation. It means not only that you have absurdly blamed yourself for a social problem, but by taking on yourself the cause of something that you're not the cause of course you feel terrible, you feel weak, you feel powerless, and that's not going to make you be part of a powerful fight-back movement.
Or a sense that you can help, you know, like many Americans, about 20% if you count all 30 successful antidepressants combined. He thought for a while taking one of those, which his routine doctor gave out, since they're given kind of like M&Ms. But he didn't feel well. He felt numb. He didn't feel it was working, because it doesn't in 75% of the time, according to the most thorough research. And he was hopeless. And he has changed. He really has changed.
The therapy is what
through
changed.
Therapy. But I am also a therapist who is informed about the social context of mental health, which I think has helped. So, and I was going to give a female version as well.
I was going to ask you, we're running out of time, but I want to talk a little bit about how men and women are affected differently.
Yeah.
And give us, if you can, an example from a female client you've had.
Well, women have a very different history in the economy. You know, 1970, about 35% of women were in the workforce. Now the workforce is approximately half female. Totally different. The recession resulted in the loss of what were 80% male jobs in the areas most sort of defined as masculine. Construction, heavy machinery, high ticket sales, aggressive marketing, that kind of thing. Those jobs have been wiped out at an unparalleled level. Now it's starting to work on social services too. Women's lower paid jobs were based around what's much more viable in a social service economy. Cooperation, being able to work with different groups of people, compromise, and so on. That's why the majority of managers in the United States are now female. What used to be a male enclave is now a female enclave. And so what's happened to women, and what has happened to one of the women that I'm thinking of, was a young woman who had wanted to be able to have a child, and she realizes in this economy she can't have a child, and she can't because she is the only person regularly working. She doesn't work at a lucrative job. You know, the big increases in jobs, there are 15 big areas for job increase. Two of them are male, 13 are female, mainly in food service and health-related. She's in a health-related industry. And she doesn't have time for political work because she's working full-time. She's taking care of the house because the husband feels so unmanned that he wants her to do more rather than less to buttress his failing ego. And she just can't manage it. And she can't refuse the overtime or not hang out a little bit with the people who would help her get a promotion because she desperately needs this. So her social connection is off. Now, she, unlike most men who are jobless, still maintains contact with her family of origin and also with her friends who give each other emotional support. She still has that in addition to her husband. But she's so overwhelmed and exhausted, because women do more work. Women do more housework than unemployed men in the same partnership do. And they just can't make it. They're trying to exist. They're treading economic water.
The interesting thing then is You've given us an explanation of why men and women, for different reasons, are not, in the United States at least, in a position. The men mentally, the women by the sheer
physically.
Exhaustion of their physical efforts, as well as their mental commitments, they can't find the time. The men can't find, let's call it the psychological space. Okay, given that and given our time constraints, do you believe, based on the kinds of analysis you've just done and the experience you've had with your patients over this crisis, do you believe that there are pressures building? You know, in both Turkey and Brazil, when the people in the streets were asked, they all said stories like, this has been building for decades. I have been frustrated and my family for decades. You know, this is just, it was the last thing. It was the straw that broke the camel's back, et cetera, et cetera. Do you feel that there is a head of steam, of resentment, of bitterness, of upset, building that might provoke in this country the kinds of activity that people have been asking about, why isn't it happening in the United States? Is something like that building, or do you think that's not the case? Well, how do you respond to that? And I admit it's an enormous question.
It's
on many people's minds. But give us your answer.
I think on the one hand, it's building. I mean, that's what Occupy was about. And for the middle class and small business owners, sponsored by large businesses, that's what the Tea Party was about, both have become weaker. But one never knows when things are going to blow. You know, that what just in my lifetime, you know, the USSR, when the U.S. was wild in the 60s, they were going along with the program. In the Arab Spring, it looked like people would tolerate the kind of oppression they'd lived under for many, many, many years. You don't really know why Turkey would explode now. Why Taksim Square would be the focus of ecological rage, economic rage, rage at religious puritanism, rage at authoritarian government. Why did it blow? No one knows. And just like in the United States, Turkey hadn't had skirmishes on anything like this level. But you know that when Americans get out of their torpor, the average man watches about 7.5 hours of television a day. When they stop just dissociating, trying to distract themselves while eating Cheetos, Fritos, and Doritos, and getting obese, they're going to be so angry having been had. But people also are humiliated. And the left has always said, you know, look how badly you're treated. Look, this is wrong and that's wrong and everything else is wrong. It makes you feel like everything's hopeless, you know, sometimes. They don't say you can do it. This is what people have done. This is strong. This is amazing. This is how you can organize. This is for you, you know. And so the United States left hasn't been viable enough to offer a vision. That's what that Imagine book is about. And when that happens, and who knows when it'll happen, it will really blow here.
So you do believe it's building.
It's
the only question is when and what.
How and where and why and when it'll explode is anybody's guess.
Dr. Farhad, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate what you had to say.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Good. In the time that remains, let me turn to your questions. We don't have time for very many, but this was a particularly important interview. So let me pick up on a couple that have intrigued me that have come in. Here's one that is, for the sheer boldness and size of the question, something that takes your breath away. How do we prevent socialism from degenerating into Stalinism? How do we prevent the idea of socialism from becoming the reality of an all-powerful government that denies basic freedoms and civil liberties to people, etc., etc. Well, of course, it's a crucial question. And to deal with it, a moment of history and then an argument. First, a moment of history. The transition from one economic system to another is never done simply, is never done by the first group of people who try it. It's always a messy, slow process full of fits and starts, some of which can turn quite ugly along the way. When capitalism, the system we have now, broke out of feudalism, the system that preceded it in most of the world, certainly in Europe, the efforts were many and diverse, and some of the early efforts at capitalism turned dictatorial, turned violent, turned grotesquely unjust, and collapsed, either by being overthrown by their own people or by fighting with one another. In other words, much of what you see in the transition from capitalism to socialism is a rerun of something we've seen before in the transition from feudalism to capitalism. Now the argument. In order to prevent a socialist system, which does assign to the government, after all, the role of a certain amount of government planning rather than the chaos of the market, which does assign to the government the ownership of means of production on behalf of the whole people rather than letting private individual groups control resources that we all depend on. These components of socialism do give an importance to the state. Then how do you prevent that importance that socialists give to the state from coming back to haunt them by becoming a power of the state way beyond what the early socialists ever dreamed of, and certainly way beyond anything they advocated? How, in the terms of this question, do you prevent socialism and the importance of the state in it from becoming Stalinism, the monster deformation of this idea? I think the answer is you must create in a socialist society a power of the mass of people at the base of society that can control and prevent the government from ever becoming the Stalinist monster. How do you do that? You have to give people at the base the real power of wealth. You have to make sure that people at the base, at the base of society, control the discretionary resources, the tools, the equipment, the money, the wealth upon which the state depends and which the state cannot take from them because the state depends on them giving it to the state, and they won't give it if the state veers away from the socialist ideals into the Stalinist alternative. And how do you do that? Well, in my own humble opinion, the way is to reorganize production, to reorganize the factories, the stores, the offices, where the work is done in a society, in a modern society, the enterprise, the home, the store, the office, whatever it is. Make that the collective production of large groups of people. Make the workers in an enterprise the people who decide what to do with the wealth they create. The only way the government can get the wealth is if they give it to them. Ah, and they will only give it to them if a decision-making body composed of all the workers, the mass of people, and all the people in the communities that interact with those enterprises, if they together give it to the government, make the government dependent on the people in the way that counts. You know, in traditional socialism, the government organized the enterprises. So all the profits of enterprise went right into the hands of the government, which could then use them for good or for ill. No, no, no. Let's not do that. Let's make the base of society independent of the government. Let's build the mass organizations of people around the job and around where you live and interaction between them. Democracy at work, democracy at home. and to create in those two democracies the institutions. I call them worker self-directed enterprises. You can call them whatever you want. People's councils, local entities of work and residence, whatever they are. Let them be the places where the work gets done, where the wealth is produced, and the government has to come and ask for that wealth to perform the functions that the people want. That way the government is always dependent as well as powerful. That's the only way I can think of to ground what the state does in a fundamental and ultimate dependence on work and working people, where they do the work, where they live, to get the resources without which the state can do nothing. So it's different from the state owning and operating enterprises. The state now becomes an agency that has to go to where the real power is, in the workers where they work and in the workers where they live. Democratic ownership of an operation of the enterprises, democratic decision of what happens in the local community. And together, they will or they won't provide a state with the resources it requires. And that's how you limit a socialism and prevent it from becoming a Stalinism. It's the best chance we have to make government work for the majority of people by making sure the majority own and operate the wealth-creating production apparatus. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you again to Dr. Frod. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff, and I hope you will join me next week.
Won't be long, long. Thing ain't gonna change. Sometime in the middle of the night, I get so lonely, so lonely, so lonely. Thing ain't gonna change. Thing ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Thing ain't gonna change. Further on up the road, baby, thing ain't gonna change.